Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat, a weekly podcast on happiness and work culture. Hi, this is Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat. I'm Bruce Daisley. It's a podcast about making work more enjoyable, about improving our work cultures. Today's episode is a live recording from Advertising Week Europe this week. It's not really about advertising. It's about bringing laughter back to our workplaces. Some incredible guests, and I'll introduce them shortly. If you like this, why not subscribe? Well, that's free. Or you can slide down the page on Apple Podcasts and give it 5 stars. That single act, strangely enough, moves us up the charts and gives more people the prompt to listen. Failing that, send it to a friend. Leave it tucked under a neighbour's windscreen wipers. Anyway, here's the show from Advertising Week Europe 2018, a session called Bringing the Laughs Back. The recording was made on the Power of Audio stage, and I merely make mention of that because there is a reference to it. Over the next 40, 50 minutes, we're going to be doing a live episode of my podcast, Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat. I'm Bruce Daisley. We've got a fantastic lineup for you. But just to make sure that everyone's in the mood, I thought we'd have a bit of audience participation. So when I shout power, you shout audio. Power?
Audio.
Power?
Audio.
Okay, let's make sure they hear this on the Power of Smell stage. So when I say power, you say audio. Power?
Audio.
Power?
Audio.
Good, right, okay, so we've got a fantastic lineup. I think the intention of the session really was that myself and Sue, who's going to be on the panel in a moment, have sort of started thinking that work's not as much fun as it used to be, right? You're going to have to take this on trust. If you're sort of a millennial, you're going to have to accept that there was a world that was a lot more fun than this is now. And broadly, my philosophy is that the way I judge this is I know people who work at Google, right? When you Google best places to work, Google comes up. I don't know whether they fix that result, but that's what happens. And I say to them, what's work like? They say, not much fun. And so that's my judge. If people at Google aren't enjoying it, then I'm guessing other people aren't enjoying it. Ask people at Facebook. They didn't seem to have much of a week either. So I'm guessing that work's not as much fun as it used to be. And in fact, myself and Sue created, that's the podcast, Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat. Myself and Sue created this manifesto. 8 changes to try and improve the way we're working. And none of these are a big deal. I mean, one of them's take a lunch, for God's sake. People who make your iPhone get a lunch break. But the rest of us are sort of struggling. We're not taking lunch breaks. We're working too hard. And so we're in a situation where people are just not enjoying work the way they used to. And in fact, one of the weird consequences of that is workplace loneliness has gone up by 30% in the last 15 years. People are lonely at work, and that's partly people who are working from home, partly people in the office who are just so committed to doing emails and meetings, they're not interacting with people. So one of the points we put on the manifesto, and you'll find the manifesto at newworkmanifesto.org, one of the points we put on the manifesto was laugh. And it's like one of the vital things that I think when we love our jobs, that we know that our jobs create for us, but we wanted to sort of bring it back. So hence, we've put a panel together that hopefully are going to try and resolve that for us. And I thought to kick us off, there was no better person than the first panelist. And so I'll introduce Professor Sophie Scott. Professor Sophie Scott gave a totally bewitching BBC Christmas lecture about laughter, an extraordinary excursion into the power of laughter. Sophie Scott is a PhD in cognitive science, a senior fellow at University College London, specialises in speech and human communication. She's just had a journey from hell to get here. I don't think she's in the most lol mood. So we're going to try and transform that. We're going to try and bring a bit of laughter back to Sophie's day. Please welcome Professor Sophie Scott. So, I think when I think about it, let me change the slide. I think when I think about it, laughter's definitely in the top three things that people do, right? It's like, it's one of the favourite things. But one thing you said was that you said there's like 5,000 papers on fear and scientific papers on fear, and there's 100 on laughter. Why don't we even study laughter? Why don't we try and understand it?
I think it's almost invisible to us a lot of the time because I think it's like a default behaviour. You notice its absence. It's such a normal thing to do when you're with the people round whom you would normally laugh. It's like that you don't remember breathing together. You don't remember laughing together. You might remember what you said, but you don't remember the laughter that goes on around it because that's so normal. That's such a basic aspect of that interaction. So I suspect it's that. I think also, scientifically, if you tell people I study laughter, people kind of hear you saying, I study tinsel and Christmas decorations and, you know, whiskers on kittens. So it's from a scientific perspective, I think people feel like you're letting the side down a bit and you're not studying proper science things, which are very, very serious things. They're not trivial and silly things. So I think there's two things. I think there's a culture we almost don't notice it a lot of the time. And as scientists, it does not feel like science.
I mean, so what is laughter? I saw you describing the Christmas lecture. You said that laughter is a bit like dancing. It's more fun when we do it with other people than do it on our own. What is laughter?
It's more like a different way of breathing than it is anything else. You just start using your intercostal muscles in a very different way than you do when you're all breathing, which you're doing right now to stay alive, or when you're breathing for speech, as I'm doing now. When you laugh, you start producing these large contractions of your chest wall. It just squeezes air out of you. So it's a very primitive way of making a sound. And it's a sound that we associate with humour. So if you ask people about laughter, when do you laugh? They'll talk about comedy and jokes and humour. If you look at people, and this is work done by Robert Provine, if you watch people and watch when they laugh, we primarily laugh simply because we're around other people. It's primed by other people being there. You're 30 times more likely to laugh if there's somebody else with you than if you're on your own. And you'll laugh more if you know those people, and you'll laugh more if you like those people. So it's social, and it's a signifier of the kind of social connection you might have with somebody. And a lot of the time, it's just straightforward communication. It's very rarely, actually, in normal conversations, we're laughing at jokes. I mean, we do laugh at jokes, but most of the time we're laughing to show that we know each other and we understand each other and we like each other and we're kind of getting references and seeing allusions.
Because I saw you use this quote by W.H. Auden. Among the things my American colleagues would ask you to unpack this.
Yes.
So should we unpack this? Among those I like, I admire, I can find no common denominator, but amongst those who I love, I can. All of them make me laugh. Now, I think your take on that is that he's got it right, but wrong in some ways, right?
Exactly, yes. So that sort of sense that you love people because they make you laugh, I think it's describing a real thing, but it's describing it almost in exactly the wrong direction. We laugh around people because we love them. Laughter can be a really true sign of somebody's real feelings for you. If somebody will make you laugh when no one else can make you laugh, that is telling you something about how you feel about that person. And similarly, if someone never makes you laugh, you know, I have a relative who's always laughs really inappropriately, and I always thought she laughs really inappropriately. And I realised when I started working on laughter, she's laughing perfectly normally. I don't join in because I don't like her. And I'm like, no, we don't have that kind of relationship. So that's in fact, I'm attributing something to her doing something wrong, and it's me. I'm describing my reaction.
Okay.
And that's what Auden's doing there. He's describing how he feels about the people that he loves. He's describing that kind of connection that he has and that makes him want to laugh around them.
You do this brilliant thing where I think you describe in the Christmas lecture, you describe how play is this universal thing that all animals do. And in fact, you show that when dogs have their two front legs down, that's the signal that no harm will happen here.
Yeah, yeah.
And you say laughter plays a similar role, it sort of signals no harm will pass here.
I think that's it. So play is really important to mammals. All mammals play, and some mammals like us and dogs and otters carry on playing throughout their whole lives. And it can be such an ambiguous behaviour. The same thing the same behaviour, if it wasn't playful, could just be violent. So what we do is we mark play. We show people that we're playing. We do it with what's called play face. It's very, very hard to do it in human adults, but it's a kind of loose, open, happy smile. Right. There's a video going viral at the moment of a baby elephant who runs over and sits on a woman, and that elephant's got play face on. It's like, oh, I'm going to get you. And it's probably slightly different for the woman. But when there's a sound associated with that, it's laughter. And so Panksepp, who's done some of the work on animal laughter, says that it's like an invitation to play. Let's do this fun activity. And play, it's very hard to define play, but it's got this notion of, I'm not going to hurt you, I'm not going to eat you, I'm not going to try and mate with you. This is fun, harmless, pointless, enjoyable stuff that we might learn something from. That's why it matters to us. But you cannot overestimate how important play is to mammals. And I think from that perspective, play and laughter probably is a really important part of our day-to-day activity. You can think maybe of conversations in which we laugh being playful things for adult humans.
And so back to the work of Robert Provine then that you mentioned. Robert Provine sort of goes through all the things that have triggered workplace instances of laughter. And it's often like, it's Jeff's turn, it's good luck with that. They're really unfunny things, right?
Yes.
And so in a work environment, when we are using laughter just to try and, I guess, what try and signal that we're bonded as a group? Is that what we're doing?
I think so. And because people won't laugh in all situations. So you won't laugh around people you dislike. And you won't laugh if you're feeling a bit exposed and a bit like, I don't quite know where we're going with this. So I can guarantee I could take any of us to see a comedian that you really like. And if I sat you in the audience and then said, enjoy the show, I'm just going to shine this light brightly on your face and watch and see when you laugh, you will stop laughing. And I know because I've tried this. I found that the hard way. And you get it with rats. Rats stop laughing if they feel anxious and not quite sure what's going on. And humans do the same thing. So it's a sign if people are laughing that they're not in that anxious state. It's a sort of, you know, it's a marker that the group's in a good place. So I think it's useful in that respect as well. And also people will, if they can, and they feel they have the right kind of connection to the people they're with, people will use laughter to turn round difficult situations, to improve mood. And it only works if everybody does it. So groups who can do that together can be more cohesive. There is a literature on workplace humour for professions that have quite stressful jobs like doctors and police and nurses. And they tend to be characterised by pretty dark humour that's quite exclusive. If you're not part of that group, you can be a bit like, I'm surprised you're laughing at that. But for that group, it works because it's just a reason for them to share laughter.
Right.
In situations where they might need to make things better.
What? So is it a coping mechanism partly and a bonding mechanism?
Exactly, partly? And it's the two together. So if we can cope with this together, it actually helps us bond together. So the thing that's interesting about laughter is that it's never just one person emitting it and somebody else detecting it and going, oh, I see that they are feeling affiliated to me. You react to it and join in with it. So if you are part of that, you feel like you're part of that group. So you're seeing it both as an emotional expression and as a social bonding phenomenon that you sort of sets up a feedback, because the more you feel part of that group, the more likely you are to laugh with it, the more likely other people are to laugh when you laugh. So it just continues to reinforce it.
Right. And so laughing, like you've sort of hinted at there, laughing like yawning is contagious, right?
Yes.
And so can you get workplaces that are more laughter orientated, or...?
I would have to assume so, because you can definitely have situations. I mean, certainly there are big cultural differences. There are parts of the world where it's simply rude to laugh in public. People will laugh at home in Japan, for example, but in the workplace, it would be offensively rude.
Get that right.
And people don't do it. And anecdotally, people from the UK who've worked in Russia find that they're considered to be a bit too smiley in the workplace. Like they're trying to get laughter going, and people are like, I don't think so. You know. And that's anecdote, that's not data. But that's certainly at a kind of world level is something you can see variation. So it makes sense that, you know, within a country, within a city, within probably on this street, there will be places where people feel more or less comfortable sharing laughter at work. And I think it matters because of it's like a tell laughter. The presence of laughter is a sign that people are in a particular level of comfort and intimacy with the people that they're around. And it doesn't mean people turning up going, oh, I've got my Apple Watch, appearing with an apple strapped to them, Apple's latest timepiece, that kind of hilarious guy at the office. It's not that we're describing. It's just the presence of laughter at all.
Right, okay, so we're going to bring on the rest of our guests to sort of extend the panel. So let me do an intro for the guests. So first up is Sue Todd. Sue is the CEO of Magnetic, an organisation that markets the magazine industry, and is the co-creator with me of the New Work Manifesto, which is just a free WordPress website. I mean, let's not make a big deal about it. Paul Coleman is a partner at Humanize, real life insight and innovation agency. He's trained thousands of people how to raise creativity and solve cultural challenges. In his spare time, he writes comedy, and not only is he a BAFTA winner, he's a BAFTA winner for Car Share, but also he got nominated this morning for another BAFTA for Car Share. So Paul Coleman will join us. Jeff Lloyd. Jeff Lloyd is best known for his appearances on Virgin and Absolute Radio, but he's sort of creating his own podcast empire, Adrift, that he runs with Annabelle Giles. Ports is a comic tragedy for anyone flailing in a sea of inadequacy, and he won the Best Podcast of the Year award for his Reasons to be Cheerful that he creates with Ed Miliband, and I think he's building even more as we speak. So please welcome the panellists.
Okay, so a little bit of interaction before we start, because this is Bruce and I's hypothesis may be flawed. We don't think it is, but we'd love to hear a little bit from you. So can you stick your hand up if you've had a job or been in a work environment for kind of 8+ years? Anybody under years? Okay, so most people in the room have had a job. No, keep them up. So keep your hand up if you think there is less humour, less laughter happening at work. Okay, all right. So Bruce is my Keith Chegwin this morning. I'm going to come over and ask some of you what you think is going on. Bruce, there's a lady there, I can see, about 8 rows back. You've kept your hand up, so what's your theory? What's your theory?
So I think there's less laughter.
Yeah, what's your theory about why?
Well, it might be because I've got more senior, the longer I've been in work, therefore I can't laugh.
Okay.
Problems of success.
Okay.
So anyone less successful who wants to explain why work's less fun? Here we go.
I think there's too many headphones in and people working in isolation. Okay. We just don't talk to each other.
Yeah. Not just literally not enough banter, not enough chat, not enough interactions.
And actually, I think as well, when people do have fun for those 5 minutes, people kind of then feel this sudden moment of guilt. Oh, God, people think I'm not working.
Why? Do you think that's changed? Do you think we've got more obsessed with worrying about what people think of us?
Yeah, without a doubt.
Productivity?
Yeah.
Yeah. Than even like 5, 10 years ago?
Without a doubt, yeah.
Wow, that's depressing, isn't it?
And I think people are scared to say what they think sometimes as well.
Okay.
Because obviously the PC kind of, God, if I'd said what I said where I work there now, people would just think I'd gone crazy or something.
Okay. But it's like a vicious circle, isn't it? Because I guess if you don't break the mould and get a level of trust, then you can't have humour. So it's really difficult, isn't it?
I checked someone this week who was talking about open plan offices and how he said open plan offices sort of knock the corners off things. And so, like, if you're in a group of four people, then you'll be honest and you'll be a real version of yourself. If you're on this vast floor of 200 people, you're slightly more adapted version. So maybe that's it, sort of worrying that you're going to upset people for saying something that
you're outside of your trust circle, I guess, in a way. It's kind of too big a risk. So I'm going to get my first question, I guess, for Jeff and Paul, who I know, in the interest of disclosure, which I've absolutely always wanted to say in public, bar Sophie, who I haven't worked with and would love to work with, I've actually worked with everyone else in some capacity over my career, and we still speak and occasionally lol together. So my first question really is, I mean, my pickup from Sophie is that, you know, laughter is about connection rather than about humour. Do we feel less connected? I mean, Bruce's point about open plan was meant to increase connection. Email and digital technology is meant to increase connection. Have we, what's gone wrong? Are we less connected? Did you get that sense?
I think we think we're probably more connected, but I think we're fooling ourselves because we never switch off and we're on social media with our work colleagues and Facebook, you know, wishing them happy birthday. It comes up, it pops up, and I've got to wish you that. So I think we think we're more connected, so I think we're fooling ourselves. Yeah. But what we're not doing is picking up that phone or going round the corner in that office and going face to face and have a conversation.
Yeah. So all the things that were meant to make us more connected have sort of done the opposite. They'd make us on a shallow level connected, but on a deep level less connected. Is that?
Yeah, I think so. I think because we think we're connected with a wider group of people.
Yeah.
And you never let any people go. So you move from one job to the next job, or I move in terms of working on one TV thing to the next TV thing. You think, oh, well, I'll stay in touch with that runner from that. We'll like each other on Twitter. We'll follow each other on Facebook.
Yeah.
And you think you're more connected than you are, but you don't really need all that. No, noise in your life. That sounds negative about that poor runner. He's a really nice guy. He's
yeah,
lovely,
yeah,
but
sure he is. It helped you win a BAFTA.
Yeah, he did.
Jeff, what do you think?
Well, there's something interesting in what Sophie says about laughter being this social cue.
Yeah.
And if I think, oh, where am I getting my laughs from these days? It's a lot of the time it's from memes and people being funny on Twitter.
Yeah.
And you've talked about that thing where if you're sitting watching a sitcom with your spouse or your mate or whatever, you're more likely to laugh out loud than you are if you're watching it on your own.
Yeah.
And surely that's got to apply to the way that we're interacting on social media as well. You know, we're all typing lol, but how many of us are really lolling or rofflemowing?
We're lolling inside.
Yeah, yeah. Internalising
or lolling. Yeah. And I mean, do you sense in terms of the jobs that you do that there's a change? I mean, do you feel it? Do you feel like these people in the audience do, that it's less fun? Is that because you're more successful as well?
I'm in my loft on my own most of the time doing podcasts, so it's difficult to have a sense.
But in terms of, like, you know, you've been a really successful broadcaster.
Yeah.
You used to go into Absolute's offices and various radio stations' offices. And I guess one part of what you do is there's an element of banter with the co-presenter.
Yes.
I mean, does there have to be an atmosphere around where the trust is high and the humour's going for you to generate a great show? And
I think so. I mean, it's a very particular thing, isn't it, a radio show or a podcast, because that's a workplace, but to some extent you're trying to create an atmosphere that then feels contagious to the people listening to it.
Yeah.
So it's quite unique in a way, because your workplace has to feel like somewhere people want to be, like they feel like they're part of a club. Where
but is it humour that does that, though? Is that what disarms people and increases that trust and makes people relax, both the listener and the...
I think absolutely it is, yeah. And, you know, you've got to be good at that, or you've got to be good at faking it.
Yes.
Some people are.
Okay. Yeah. And Sophie, just to pick up back on your point about, I'm really interested in this point about signalling and the idea that it's kind of, you know, once you've laughed a couple of times, you're pretty much saying to people, I'm okay, it's all right, the trust's gone up, we can play, we can take some risks. Is there a correlation between, if there's less laughter, there's probably less risk taking? Which is, I guess, an issue for us in all work environments, because we all know we need to, you know, come up with new ideas and break, you know, change things all the time. That's the kind of mantra.
I'd have to point you back to the fact that there's very little research into laughter, full stop. Sadly, so it's entirely possible that there is, but literally nobody's looking at it.
Right.
So it's entirely possible that there are really interesting studies on married couples showing that people can sort of negotiate stressful situations into a positive direction by how they use laughter together. They have to both laugh. If one person's going, oh, it's very irritating when I do that, and the first person's going, it's a massive problem. You know, no one feels better. But if they can kind of, you know. And I think those studies are really interesting. And in fact, those couples stay together for longer and they're happier. And I don't think it's limited to romantic relationships. I think that's describing a kind of an emotional connection you could have with someone, possibly even transiently.
Yeah.
You can kind of negotiate a better mood together. It would certainly suggest that laughter is something that you could be using to fundamentally regulate the emotional state of a group of people in a direction where other things might then be possible.
Okay. Paul, you work, one part of your world, we'll come on to the second part of your world in a second, your BAFTA award-winning world, is helping companies and working with businesses on play and creativity and ideas generation. Can you see the correlation between this kind of humourless or less joyful, less laughter-based environment and what you're trying to do for people?
Yeah, I mean, and on one part, as we go into these organisations over the last 5-6 years, you've kind of noticed levels of fun, I want to give it a label, have kind of deteriorated. But I think that goes back to the point that they're much more connected. There's less willingness to shut down the laptop, to put the phone to one side and be in the room and lean into those sessions.
Yeah.
But when we're running those sessions, it's kind of, even though it's a creative session, you go, let's all be playful here. You start with rules on creativity, because you need to get everybody going along on the same path, going along on the same journey. So they all have to agree to go, we're going to be like this. So you're kind of doing fast track to the bonding that you talk about. Yeah. So if it's kind of getting that group that may not know each other very well, may not work with each other every day, but getting to fast track to be in a good space, to be playful and to have fun, and therefore then the creativity comes. Mm. But allowing them to fail in that room is really important. Mm. And that's in both worlds, whether that's teaching creativity, whether that's being writing comedy, you've got to go, this will be crap, it doesn't matter, we'll get to a good point with this. If we don't start with something, we'll never get anywhere. And being able to laugh at that's rubbish and not taking that to heart is really important, I think.
But I get that when you're on an away day and when you're away somewhere and when you're all together. And Bruce's point, I think, is really valid about what happens when you sit at a different desk every day. You know, now we've got more remote working, now we've got different sort of sharing of desks and we don't all sit together. You don't get the day-to-day interactions in businesses and teams as much as you used to, do you? So you get the kind of forced bit when you're off-site, but you don't get the kind of... I guess it's just slower to build that level of trust and inject that laughter-based environment.
If people like the average British person does 16 hours a week of meetings, right, and 140 emails, so you always feel like you're a bit guilty. It's like, and you blame yourself for it, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, my God, I'm so behind on all that stuff.
Yeah.
That... messing around and laughing would feel like you're sort of taking the piss a bit.
There was a bit of judgment going on in one corner of the room.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. Jeff, in terms of like the craft then of trying to kind of making sure you've kind of got something that once you transfer it to on air, whether it's a podcast or a radio show, is going to work and going to have that element of banter and humour. How do you make sure the presenter or the co-presenter or the person you're working with is someone you can do that with? Do you just know? Because you meet them at a pub or
I think you just know. Yeah. So radio stations will often, they'll launch a new breakfast show and they'll think, OK, we've got to look for, you know, the funny person and the cynical person and the person who's the head teacher. And I think, you know, often when they cast it like that, it ends up feeling really phony. Yeah. I think it's much better. Like everything I've ever done, it's just been, you find somebody you have a bit of a click with and you think, oh, what could we make out of this then?
Yeah.
Which is how the podcast with Ed Miliband came about. He came on the radio show.
Tell us how you met Ed Miliband.
Well, he came on the radio show in the run-up to the 2015 election.
Yeah.
And I'd seen him kind of speak at a couple of events and he'd take questions from the audience and he'd be really natural and funny.
Yeah.
But when I saw him on Newsnight, you know, he wasn't coming across like that at all. So I thought, well, is there a way of drawing that side out of him in the interview?
Yeah.
Which it did, and it went, I heard a good phrase the other day, it didn't go viral, it's overstating it, but it went a little bit fungal. So it's not my phrase, somebody said that to me. And then, you know, when I was thinking about what I wanted to do next, I just thought, oh, well, there was something in that. So when I went to Ed with the idea, it was partly because I thought he'd be a good fit for the idea, but partly because there was a bit of a click. And when those things don't come along that often.
So
you've got to sort of think of
but
a way.
But it's really interesting, that podcast, isn't it? And I think Bruce mentioned that it won the Pressed Writers Best Podcast Award just a couple of weeks ago, you and Ed. And it's called Reasons to be Cheerful. And so the subject matters, serious issues that we all face. I listened to the one just this week on homelessness and how you can, you know, how in Finland they've got rid of it and some ideas to do it here. So it's really serious topics with, you know, a previous, you know, very senior politician, but there's loads of banter and humour in it. So I just wonder whether, back to that lady's point up there about, you know, we're in serious times, we don't feel we can laugh as much. Actually, we need it more than ever.
I wonder as well, you know, that thing that Ed obviously had work face on, right?
Right.
Where we've sort of got these sort of look serious, performative seriousness.
Yeah.
And like sometimes it's impossible to escape it. You feel like, I sort of, you know, this is really earnest, I've got to go into this.
Yeah. Well, he will talk about that. He will talk about the fact when he was leader, it was almost like there was a 6-second delay in his head.
Right.
So thinking, okay, if I say that, will it be made out of a headline? Because, I mean, even now, he went on Nick Robinson's podcast a few weeks ago, and towards the end, Nick Robinson said, so Arnold Schwarzenegger then in the Terminator, what was his catchphrase? And Ed quite innocently says, oh, I'll be back. And then the BBC News website run a headline which says, I'll be back, Miliband plotting a return to frontline politics.
Get out.
No, seriously.
It must be like, once you've been snapped eating a bacon sandwich and it's become a bleeding meme across the world, you must be like, I'm never going to do anything.
Yeah, but I think something that frustrates him, like every week we get a ton of email from new listeners who will say, God, if I'd known you were like this, I would have voted for you. I think he feels like he was always like that. He was just never given the room to be himself. So creating environments is an important thing. And with this podcast, it is sort of quite meaty topics, but I didn't want it to feel like something that was just for policy wonks and people who read like long reads in broadsheet newspapers.
Yeah.
I wanted it to be the sort of people who sort of listen to TED Talks or get their news from The Daily Show.
Yeah.
So the front part of that is the first 10 minutes or 8 minutes or whatever it is just us kind of chatting about our weeks or our reasons to be cheerful to create an environment which doesn't feel intimidating to people.
To have a more honest debate, maybe, or a more useful or authentic debate.
Yeah.
So if we could just transfer that into our daily works. But I guess we've got these problems in the way, haven't we? We've got the problem where you sat with a different person maybe every day, or like you say, you feel like you're projecting to 200 people in open plan offices. Is there a case for going back to putting the wall
walls back up, do you think?
Yeah.
Shall we?
Yeah.
We can't canvas it to put the walls back up. Yeah.
He'd say that because he hates people.
I like the idea of people.
Okay.
So, actual people.
I love that. So we promised lols, didn't we? We've had a couple. But I think almost to guarantee at least one other smile, I'm going to play the cheap gag of actually showing a clip of car share. Because, and then I'm going to talk to Paul a little bit about the craft of coming up with something like this. So if you could just run the clip.
Well, that's not much of an away day, staying in work.
It's not all day either. It's only 11 till 3.
It's like a long lunch. What's on your agenda?
This one's about team building, trust strategies, and motivational role play.
What a load of hoopty.
Why?
Well, it is. Just a waste of money. I'm sure it could be put to better use.
Like?
Well, the vending machine's been stuck on Scotch broth since the Olympics. And the disabled toilet's got a crack in it. I nicked my bum twice last week.
You shouldn't even be using it.
Oh, come on, we've all done it.
I've not.
Job's worth.
So, Paul, you've got a kind of dual perspective here. I mean, congratulations on the BAFTA. Out of curiosity, when you've got another job, I mean, how do you make sure when it comes to the bit about trying to write comedy, you're in the right mindset? And do you have to kind of, back to Jeff's point, create a certain environment to be in the mood for any form of creative writing and creating of humour and comedy?
You do, yeah. I mean, you kind of... You try and get yourself in that good place, but sometimes you sit there and you go, it's not happening today. And then you've got to just think, either walk away or force something and then look at it the day after and go, what was I thinking? This is just rubbish.
Right.
But yeah, so sometimes you've got a deadline, you've got to force yourself to do it.
Yeah.
But it's hard when it's not there. So it's kind of hard in that way when you're on your own to create that environment that feels right. So if we get together with Sean and Peter, get together and write, some days we'd just end up looking at YouTube clips. That'd be it.
Right. Just to change the atmosphere.
Because the writing's not there, so let's just have a laugh and look at these and enjoy our company, and then we'll talk about some plot lines, and then we'll come back to those later in the week or next week.
Right, because you can't fake it.
You can't, no. Yeah. But, and that's, you know, but also allowing ourselves to be a bit bored in that situation is really important, because that ups our curiosity.
Yeah.
If we're just sat there going, well, we've only written 3 lines, we need to write 4 lines, we need to write 5 lines, and there's some kind of measurement to go on with. You're allowing yourself to be curious and look at other things gives you that, feeds the other work, I think.
Yeah.
But that doesn't happen in a workplace. So when I go into the other world, nobody's allowed to be bored. If you walk past them and they're just looking out the window, it's kind of, you're thinking, why are we paying them?
But I think work used to be like that. I think that might be back to the lady's point earlier. I think that might be one of the problems. I think this need for productivity and to look pressurised and look like we're constantly busy and not kind of slightly feet up, reading something, taking something in, that would act as stimulus in terms of both ideas, but also just a bit more of a relaxed atmosphere where a bit of chat might happen.
I mean, there's a danger, though. There's a danger, because you could have those people who just like spend the day looking at YouTube videos, pretending that they're actually going, being curious, and I'm getting...
You'll get found out eventually, won't they? I always just say you'll get found out eventually if all you do is watching YouTube videos. I mean, I think we've probably lost something in creating that sort of slightly more relaxed, even if it's for 15 minutes a day.
Mm. Well, especially if you're doing 140, instead of the YouTube videos, it's 140 emails a day.
Yeah.
It's just at least it's a slightly better climate that you're working in, right?
Yeah, totally. Slightly personal question. Were you funny at work before you were funny on screen?
I worked with you two, so maybe you should answer that.
Jeff, what do you think? Was Paul funny at work?
I worked with Paul during my alcoholism, so my memories of those years are a little...
What I love is that we were chatting before, and both of you attribute the other one for introducing you to the internet.
Yeah.
Who introduced who to the internet?
So I thought it was Jeff. I tell people it's Jeff Lloyd showed me the internet. I think it's my go-to story.
But I think the internet was on your desk.
Maybe it wasn't.
By default.
I didn't realise it was there.
Yeah,
you just came and said, you've got this internet thing. Yeah.
There's a way to estrange half the audience. The internet was on Paul's desk.
It was.
No one in the building there was
one computer that would go on the internet.
So, Sophie, you work in an academic environment, and obviously you're one of the people who's done these 100 pieces of research about laughter. Can you see on a day-to-day practical level the challenges of work and less humour and interactions? Does it feel like, practically speaking, it's also an issue for you with your colleagues?
For me, it is difficult because as I've got older, I've got more senior, so I'm a professor now, and people, it's got a
got
different...
Got to be humourless.
People have different expectations, it turns out.
Right.
But it's... I'd certainly, within, because all you've really got control over in academia is your lab and your students, and I try to keep an atmosphere going where we make a lot of time to do things that would be, you know, we have a journal club, we go and do it at the zoo.
Oh, okay.
And so then
okay.
we go and look at the otters because we like otters.
Yeah.
Like long mammals. We go and see the long mammals at the zoo. Meerkats, mongooses, otters.
To be fair, they look like they're having more fun at the zoo.
They are awesome, yeah. actually. Yeah. And it's quite a deliberate strategy just to sort of get people's head out of the sitting at their computer all the time and have a just a place where people, we can have a, I mean, I feel slightly unwell even saying it, but you know, we can have some fun.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
we talk about some work and then we go and talk about otters. And it's quite a deliberate strategy on my part to try and have that sort of emotional tone in the lab. And I took a decision a few years ago that I wasn't going to work with people I didn't like.
Yeah.
And that was because life is just too short and it tears everything to pieces. If there's one person in the lab, it's not, everyone else doesn't get on with.
Yeah.
So it's implicitly kind of trying to foster a situations where laughter can happen and people are doing stuff other than work
yeah.
are built into the work week.
Yeah,
you mentioned play before, and like I worry with the word play. Anytime we think of play at work, it's all a bit beardy. No offence to beards, Jeff. It's all a bit sort of, it's like, let's go to a ball pit in Hoxton. And
now
all,
we're having play.
We're all playing around, we're having great ideas. And it just feels, it actually sort of turns a lot of people off. How do you bring a bit of that stupidity and idea creation and play, let's use the word, to an office without using the word play?
Well, I suppose you've got to be able to read the room and work out what would work for those people, because as you say, you just can't force it. Like, you know, the kind of that everyone, people frequently have quite an ab reaction to somebody turning up with like red noses and, oh, let's be hilarious. And it's, you've got to maybe almost trick people into it by presenting it as something else. Sometimes that's what I frankly do at work. Don't do something I assume will be fun for people, but we don't frame it that way initially. And the bottom line has to be, it's something that you are reading as being appropriate, and it's a social skill being able to do that. Interestingly, if you look at people's ability to identify and understand social laughter, like how people use laughter in conversations, that's something that continues improving throughout your entire early adult life. Performance doesn't peak until people are in their late 30s.
Wow.
And the other stuff that correlates with that, not most stuff that we do is in place by the time you hit puberty or in place by the time your brain's fully matured at the end of your teens, and then it gracefully declines. Some things continue improving, and laughter is one of them. But the other things that go with it are things like empathy and social skills. So because you learn about them in interactions with other people. So it's not something that works out of the box. It's something you learn how to do and you can get better at doing, and you learn by doing it.
It's interesting, though, isn't it? Because if people are laughing less at work and chatting less at work, then maybe that's not evolving in the same way, right?
It's, or they're getting more senior and it's almost wiping it out. So kind of in theory, more senior people should be more skilled and understand the value of creating an environment where...
And they can be. I mean, you can think of examples of senior people who are very, very good at using like humour. I mean, Bill Clinton was phenomenally good at using laughter. There's that whole bit thing where Yeltsin's doing a speech and screaming at the press, and Bill Clinton reacts, this is from the 90s, reacts as if he's being funny and just starts laughing.
Yeah.
And in the end, Yeltsin starts laughing like, I am very funny, and everyone's laughing. And it completely changes the mood to a completely deliberate act on Clinton's part.
Yeah.
And that's, so a lot of what we think of as sort of charming, even high status behaviour can involve very cleverly using laughter and play to make people feel comfortable, make difficult situations better. Because a high status person, people will follow if they do that.
So Jeff, back to Ed, do you think that's, I mean, has he ever recognised, or would you think that that's what maybe he should have done? That if he had his time again, showed a little bit more of his sense of humour and a little bit more of his kind of vulnerability, and he might have done all right, better, at least.
Yeah, I think, sorry, I made a weird noise then. I've got slight back pain, and when I said it sort of came out, it was, I lifted my son up yesterday and it's really done for me. I'm a real soldier for being here today. maybe. I think he has seen the value in being a bit looser.
A bit more relaxed.
But it can feel weird when it comes from the top down as well. Like workplace, like different places I've worked in, when it feels like the culture of the place is just having a laugh and being funny with your workmates, that can feel good and feel like, oh, this is a special place to work, and maybe they pay you a bit less or expect a bit more of you. Yeah. But then sometimes if it feels like the boss, you know, once a week needs to write the wacky email or whatever, it can be a bit cringy. Yeah.
So you worked for Chris Evans, didn't you, in the sort of the Virgin takeover days?
Yeah, that was an interesting one.
He was like the definitive wacky boss that I think every newspaper would look at.
Yeah.
Was that the experience? It was like a wacky,
well, kind
fun
of.
Place
it was
to
a
work.
Weird thing because even though he owned the radio station, he did his breakfast show, and then he wasn't that hands-on. He just had some kind of bosses to run it. And he would kind of take the piss out of them. So he almost felt like, even though he was the owner, like this anti-establishment figure. So you'd be the famous one is one day, I think it was a Tuesday, it's about 11 o'clock, and an email goes around the whole company from Chris's PA saying, Chris has bought a new shirt and wants to celebrate, so everyone to the pub. And then just like the whole company decamps to the pub next door, his credit card's behind the bar, and then no work got done for the rest of the day.
What was the shirt like?
It was, you know, predictably wacky. You know,
right.
Sure, it was very floral. But we talked about this last week, didn't we? That booze is so integral in British work. You know, when you think of the times you've had a laugh at work, there's so often booze involved, and sort of the pros and cons of that.
Now we just got fuzzball.
No, well, I presume that the booze thing is, like, we're spending time together, we're getting to like each other, we're laughing more, and then booze helps that laughter. But actually, booze is quite exclusive as well, isn't it? Sort of you often don't notice the couple of people slinking off and not coming to the pub. And
Yeah. I mean, I've had it since I've been sober for 17 years, I think, and I've become a terrible misanthrope. I never go to anything. I remember going to because, you know, you feel like you have to turn up. I remember going to the Works Christmas party a few years ago, and I just didn't want to go. So I thought, I wonder if I can stay for 20 minutes. But in that 20 minutes, I'll take so many selfies that I'll put them up on Facebook, and it'll look like I had this really wild night. I managed it, and people were like, oh, great night last night. Nobody noticed you left after 20 minutes.
No, that's, they were all drunk.
Yeah, it's a big benefit of social media.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
It's a tiny bit more audience interaction before we finish. We're coming to the end. So, Bruce, back up. So, hands up who has a table tennis table, fuzzball, you know, one of those table footballs or table tennis in their office. Yeah, a couple of
people. You think
people.
They're good?
Yeah.
I think table tennis, well, I'll ask you, but I think they're like the new, you don't have to be mad to work here,
yeah,
but
totally.
It helps.
My theory is that kind of forced fun and that has replaced genuine interaction and humour. What's your view?
Yeah, so I work for Lego.
Bruce,
we've been
must be mad
chatting
there.
A little bit there. It's, so it is mad, but I think the play thing is really interesting. So the foosball table is in the middle of the office.
Yeah,
it's on one of our more open plan areas.
Yeah,
and it's just, you know, any of those kind of game opportunities, any of the opportunities to bring kind of play into the office, I think is where you see exactly what you're saying: people breaking down barriers and being more empathetic with one another. It's, you know, because so much, we reflect on this all the time doing what we do, right? We make toys, so that's should be hopefully part of the culture.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, play is absolutely, you know, one of the biggest reasons for doing it. But it shouldn't just be about foosball tables or, you know, kind of going abseiling with Malcolm.
But what is, we've got a bit over-reliant on them. That's my worry, that they've become the default. I mean, you know, I'm just interested if anyone's got any other experiences of things
that they've
kind of replaced
it. Yeah, and I saw that Slack said that they don't have those things. You know, Slack, the sort of the messaging app.
Yeah.
Because they said they wanted people to leave at 6 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And almost it was sort of, they were to try to make work feel like this fun environment. And I think increasingly the fact that we don't have a separation between work and home space is what's causing some of the strains of work, right? Anyone else got a perspective on that?
Yeah, the whole ping pong thing, what it's done in my experience is create a kind of a culture of ping pong bullies. So you sort of go there and you want to have a go and think, oh, you know, I'll get involved in this. This will be great to meet some people and whatever. And then eventually you get played off the park by a millennial who's been on it all day.
Just another way to feel inadequate.
And now I just feel genuinely intimidated when I step out the lift and there's people there with their topspin backhand serves and all that kind of stuff. And actually it's had the exact opposite effect, I think, on most other people.
Yeah. So what has replaced the kind of the banter that we're observing, I think, as reduced in the workplace? It's not foosball and table football. I mean, what's your sense of... Because forced fun, in my experience, never seems to work. And I think you were alluding to that earlier.
Yeah.
What's replaced it? Bruce, on your, I'll ask you guys as well. You talked about Crisp Tuesday on a podcast recently. Do you want to just explain that?
Yeah, but I was just... I'm interested in, like, these little things. Like, the problem with modern work is that unless you can measure it, people think it's got no value. And so these sort of stupid things where, you know, if you ask someone to analyse their favourite meeting of the week, often a lot of works that seem to have a good culture seem to have these sort of irrelevant Friday afternoon meetings or Monday meetings or Crisp Thursdays, the one I heard, where people turn up and it's like there's almost no agenda.
Purpose, yeah.
And actually, all you end up doing, because there's no agenda, it's quite trivial, and there's like a brief update of what's happened in the office that week. They end up having a brief chat with people around the office, who then they build like a bit of rapport. Sort of replaces the pub a bit. Mm. But, of course, if someone looks at the output of that, and there's all these rubbish status meetings that unfortunately give meetings a bad name. But, you know, so as a result, someone looks at that and says, well, that's the one we're going to get rid of. Missing the fact that that was the one that made the magic.
Yeah.
That was the one that actually made you like other people.
Yeah. So that's the common thread, I think, from what you guys were saying. Your observation about writing with Peter and Charn and it being kind of, if it's not working, let's just put some YouTube, let's just relax, let's take the pressure off that we're not, it's not happening today. And I guess the same when you're devising a show, you know, we've got to go out and do it, but if it's not, you know, let's just kind of relax ourselves down a bit and create a different atmosphere.
I remember interviewing a neuroscientist, I can't remember who it was, but saying that actually your best ideas come when you know that mode your brain can get into where you eventually, shit, what was I thinking of there?
Yeah.
That's the best phase that your brain can be in for thinking up ideas and things.
Right. Is that the neuroscientist on the panel? Is that
I mean, I think so. One of the things that's really interesting about primate brains, and you see it if you go to like the zoo, we're just constantly seeking novelty.
Mm.
And if you give us stuff to do, we'll do it. But if you give it a bit of space where you are creating your own novelty, that's when your brain can go off in all sorts of directions because that's what it wants to do. It pretty much never just stops until you go to sleep or die. And that's... so it's like this... If you can let that machine keep running and give it a bit of space to do that. I mean, it's actually whatever you want to call it, but you know that kind of mood when you find yourself like, oh, hang on, almost like you've been working things out without realising it. And that's not something that happens if you're completely occupied doing something else. It just will never occur.
Yeah, so in the workplace, that novelty could be new noise. Yeah. So whether that's being dragged into a meeting or checking stuff on social media, and then you've not got that space to then...
Yeah. Have your produce your own
and
novelty.
Be curious and, okay, understood.
So quick fire, a couple of questions to finish. So funniest person or funniest team you've ever worked in, you can't say Peter Kay, and biggest dickhead.
it's been recorded.
You'll edit it out if it's
biggest dickhead. Funniest person, I'll answer that first and then we'll move on. Leslie Douglas, when I worked at Radio 2, she was the controller at Radio 2 and she was just great fun in all meetings. I remember being interviewed by her for the job and I thought, I could go for a drink with you.
Yeah.
And I knew if I was offered the job, I was going to say yes because of that reason.
Right.
And she was great.
So individuals can make a huge difference.
Yeah, made a huge difference because I knew that she was kind of at the head of that, so everybody else was kind of...
Yeah, would follow that lead.
Yeah.
Yeah, So it is a leadership issue, is it?
Yeah.
Jeff, what do you think?
No, mine isn't a leader. It was one of the other DJs, Craig Cash, who went on to co-create The Royal Family and Early Doors, and he was just so funny. And we all got fired off the radio at quite a similar time, and they were all right. They went on to you know, create Mrs. Merton. They did give me a job eventually, actually. I had a job which was just fetching Benson and Hedges and Asti Spumanti for Caroline on the nights they were recording. But so I had to go and work in a video shop, and there was a fax machine there. And the fax machine, when they were writing Mrs. Merton, the amount of faxes I would receive that were just sort of drawings of either genitalia or bumholes. Yeah. Which, that was part of our process. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Some things are left in the past. Sophie?
I had a PhD student who was very, very funny. Right. She really was extremely funny. I miss her a great deal.
And did she create a certain atmosphere in the office or in the...
Yes, yeah. And just, I mean, I was actually trying to draw it out on Facebook yesterday. I was in Sweden. I thought, oh, something's happened she might find funny. If I put this out here about... She likes the Eurovision Song Contest. So I was like trying to get her to be funny on my page, specifically because I knew it would make me laugh, stuck in the middle of Sweden, as I was yesterday. Yeah. And absolutely, it was delightful.
Okay, so my very, very, very last question. If you were running for election for the More Laughter at Work party, what would your suggestion be? What can we do? What can people in this room do?
Abolish meetings.
Abolish meetings?
Abolish meetings.
Abolish meetings, okay. Apart from the ones that are about crisps.
Yeah, I mean, just like that's messing around, isn't it?
Yeah. Crisp Thursday.
Crisp Thursday. Yeah. You're taking that one back
yeah.
from the office.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I mean, like I say, I work on my own a lot of the time.
So. You just can't have Pringles in the loft. Yeah. Yeah.
The very Moorish. Once you pop, you can't stop. Yeah. Paul?
I think I'd get rid of company values, and I know we've not touched on that massively, right. But it irritates me when the senior guys in a business go, "These are our values," and nobody underneath them talks about them.
Right. Are they too restrictive?
I think they're really restrictive.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And they might have one in there that's have fun, but then. Don't do anything to have fun, so I'd get rid of those.
Yeah. Sophie, what would your kind of manifesto item be?
I think something similar, actually. We tend to be, certainly in academia, there's a move to try and make us behave in a way that's kind of in line at all times with the views of the university, and it's completely, completely at odds with how anybody normally works, and it stops you doing anything fun or interesting. Well, obviously, you don't try and destroy the university. That's a given. Okay, that's why you work there. That wasn't your aim.
Values.
And exactly, so you the freedom to actually manage this the way you'd like to.
Yeah, take a little bit of the restrictions and the freedom and the pressure away. Cool. Okay, all good. So thank you to the panel. Thank you, Paul, Panton, Jeff. Thank you, Sophie. I hope you got some ideas. And I mean, my takeaway is, you know, genuinely individual people can make a difference here. So if we all go back and just inject a little bit, let more humour into work, we'll all have a nicer time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. All the previous episodes are at eatsleepworkrepeat.fm. If you're new today, there's some ace old episodes. The Dan Pink one's good. There's a really good interview with Daniel Coyle. There's lots of fabulous stuff there. Do send us your feedback. You can hit me up on LinkedIn. I'm Bruce Daisley. Or you can tweet us by searching Eat Sleep Work Repeat. See you next time.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This season, prepare for every season with the Allbirds Mizzle Collection. These shoes were made for adventures in rain, shine, mist, or snow. Go to allbirds.com and use code FRESHSOCKS for a free pair of socks with purchase.